You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risks. We planned for every contingency. But I always promised the American people that I would be straight with you.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. America this week has gotten out of its longest war, and that's including the Civil War and Reconstruction. We have just left Afghanistan. So to help us think about what that means, think about whether it was a good idea to have left, whether it was a good idea to have been there in the first place, we have with us today Dr. Paul Miller, professor of practice at Georgetown University, who also served as director of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Help me with this, Paul. You were the director of Afghanistan and Pakistan issues for the National Security Council for both Bush and Obama. Is that right?
That's right. For the NSC staff under both Bush and Obama. That's correct.
Right. Let's start with why. Why were we in Afghanistan? What was America doing there?
Yeah. So thanks for having me on the show, Coyle. It's good to see you again. And I think this might actually be my second appearance on your podcast.
I think this is your third, because you were here for your book, and then we did a September 11th episode.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Well, then it's good to be back again.
Yeah.
And always happy to do so in the future. So let's see. Why were we in Afghanistan in the first place? 20 years ago, 9/11, terrorists from the Al-Qaeda terrorist group attacked America and killed 3,000 people. I should pause and say, of the 3,000 people, several hundred were not Americans, included people from something like 80 different nations. So it was an attack on America, an attack on the world. Those terrorists were headquartered in Afghanistan and had been for the previous 5 or so years. The United States demanded that the government of Afghanistan hand over Al-Qaeda and give access to all the training camps. The government of Afghanistan refused. So President Bush, I think sensibly, said that we were going to declare war on Al-Qaeda and on anyone that shielded, aided, hid, or abetted them. And that included the government of Afghanistan, which was led by a group called the Taliban. And that is what led us into Afghanistan.
Now, did the government of Afghanistan, if they had said, yeah, we're willing to, did they have the ability to deliver Al-Qaeda?
Yes, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have always been very tightly interwoven. Bin Laden was not simply kind of a random stranger touring Afghanistan. He was a bankroller. He bankrolled the Taliban. He gave them a lot of money. I think that I might have this backwards. Either he married one of Mullah Omar's daughters, or the other way around. Maybe Mullah Omar married one of his. There's intermarriages across the levels of fighters from between the Al-Qaeda and Taliban.
Sure.
Again, they're very tightly interwoven at a personal level. So, Mullah Omar knew where bin Laden was. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, I've seen reports that he did offer to hand over bin Laden to a neutral third party, probably meaning Pakistan, while an international investigation was able to investigate whether or not Al-Qaeda was actually responsible. That was transparently a delaying tactic. He didn't mean it. We all know that. And so the United States, again, I think rightfully, justly, initiated a war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
We don't have to go into detail on this. This actually wasn't our first digging into Afghanistan, right? It wasn't our first involvement in a war there. Is anything from our previous interaction with people in Afghanistan relevant that you want to bring in here?
So the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979. The United States, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia gave a whole lot of money and weapons to the Afghan people to fight back. That lasted 10 years. Soviet Union lost. Afghanistan plunged into civil war, and we walked away. We didn't really help put the country back. No assistance, no help mediating a peace, no help rebuilding the country. What's relevant is that, number one, the devastation in Afghanistan today is still from the Soviet war. Most of the destruction isn't from the 20-year war we just ended. It's actually from the Soviet war, which was near genocidal in its level of violence. The second thing to note is that the factions that fought the Soviet Union then fell to fighting against each other. One became the Taliban. Most of them did not. Most of them actually became something called the Northern Alliance that fought against the Taliban and became our allies in the war after 2001. So that's the kind of relevant background from the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. So we did not break Afghanistan originally. That was the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that. Yeah, that's correct.
Now, 20 years later, maybe we haven't fixed it, but we certainly didn't cause the initial difficulties.
That's right.
And from what I understand, when the Soviets showed up, Afghanistan was doing fairly well, kind of on a modernizing, westernizing track, slow, but moving that direction.
Yeah, it was a pretty normal, poor, developing country, kind of a post-colonial state. They had been trying in fits and starts to do some modernization from the 1920s on forward. Kabul, there was no insurgency. There was no drug trade. Of course, there was corruption. The government ministries were sort of not terribly functional, but they worked for what they were. 1964, the king handed down a democratic constitution. They held elections in 1965, 1969. So yeah, they're doing the same things that many other developing countries are doing around the world at the same time. 1973, there's a coup. It kind of plunges things in a bit of a difficulty. There's a counter coup in 78, and then it plunges into civil war, and then the Soviet Union comes in. So the Soviet Union comes in the middle of a war that has started just about 18 months prior to that.
So we invade Afghanistan in 2002. Should we have invaded Afghanistan? So you've said, yeah, you think it was the right call.
Yeah.
Can you maybe go into a little bit of detail on that, or do we have to buy your book?
No, I'm happy to give you the short version here. My most recent book is on just war. And, the oldest and strongest axiom of just war is you have a right to self-defense. Al-Qaeda plainly attacked us without warning and murdered thousands of people. And so we had every right to defend ourselves against future attacks and seek to bring them to justice. Now, the tricky thing here is, some people now say we should have gone in, dropped some bombs, killed some terrorists, and gone home. Would not have been a very successful war because we would have killed some bad guys, and then they would have come right back. It's very easy to imagine how the Taliban would have stayed in power or come right back into power, and how Al-Qaeda would have reconstituted itself and found safe haven in Afghanistan and Pakistan if that's all we had done. It was very obvious that we needed to stay and try to put something together so that Afghanistan itself could deny safe haven to terrorists even after we left. And that's what we've been kind of trying to do ever since, although I want to stress kind of. I'd say that we stayed, we talked about it, we didn't actually do a whole lot to put a legitimate authority back together in Afghanistan. And I imagine we're going to get into that chapter of the story next.
Yeah, so that's actually my next question here is what were we trying to accomplish, not just in the initial strikes, in response to September 11th, but with the longer range occupation.
Yeah. Just to pick a nit on that word occupation, that does have a legal meaning in international law. And,
sure.
Yeah. And Iraq was under occupation for 1 year, and then we transferred sovereignty to the Iraqi government. Afghanistan never was. The Bonn Conference put back together an Afghan interim authority in December of 2001, and they governed Afghanistan. It was never under international occupation, just as a little small note. And we hardly had any troops there. Again, by contrast to Iraq, we invaded with 100,000 troops. In Afghanistan, we had about 2,000 troops by the end of 2001, and like 5,000 a year after that. So in answer to your question, our initial aim was to kill bad guys and sort of keep the pressure on to deny them safe haven. And we did that for 5 or 6 years while we tried to get the United Nations and our allies to do the work of state building, of reconstruction and development. It was badly coordinated. There was a lot of wasteful efforts. We all understood the basic idea, got to put something together so we can leave someday. And so we sort of tried to outsource it. Totally failed. After 5 or 6 years, the Taliban had come back because there was no authority in the provinces. There was a power vacuum. The Taliban was like, okay, we can come right back. Nobody's stopping us. There's no Afghan army. There's no Afghan government way out in the provinces. So we're going to just come back and announce ourselves. So they came back, and it was very evident to us, to the international community, we needed to take a different approach. And so we attempted to kind of shift course. The United States stepped into a leading role to reconstitute the Afghan army and police. That's when the serious effort started to really train the Afghan security forces. It started as late as like 2007. And by 2010, there was an army of some size in place capable of fighting the Taliban. From that time forward, we actually tried to do a counterinsurgency strategy, which again, we didn't do for the first 5 or 6 years. But starting in 07 or so, we really put out an effort at counterinsurgency, training the Afghan army and police. And we talked about building the Afghan government. We still didn't do a whole lot about it because we're just kind of allergic to this sort of thing. So years go by without any meaningful action about sort of building the Afghan state. You want me to keep going?
No, keep going. This is interesting. I have questions because I remember the election of Karzai. So there's you know, some kind of something there.
Yeah. So I would call that political reconstruction. Right. The Afghans led a process called the Bonn process. They agreed upon a constitution, which, by the way, was just a copy and paste from their 1964 constitution. They did hold a couple rounds of elections, and we paid for it, and we helped ensure that it came off safely. And so we participated. We ensured the success of political reconstruction. But the actual government, the ministries, the rule of law, the roads, schools, hospitals, it was just completely neglected. There was, again, the allies did a few things here and there, but never at scale, never at the scale required to really make a dent in the depth of Afghanistan's state failure. It's the most failed state in the world, been comprehensively destroyed by the Soviets and then mismanaged by the Taliban. You just don't get more shattered than Afghanistan was, and we didn't do a whole lot about it. Sometimes you hear people say today that we've been like nation building in Afghanistan for 20 years. What have we got for it? Okay. We haven't been nation building in Afghanistan for 20 years. We did some serious state building from about 2007 to about 2011, and that was it. About 4 short years, we put out a meaningful effort. Before that, it was mostly whack-a-mole with terrorists. And after that, it was again whack-a-mole with terrorists. Just kind of mowing the lawn, killing bad guys, hoping that they would sort of go away or that the problem would simmer down to a manageable level. And of course, that never happened. And since we never did build an Afghan state, there was nothing to stand when we left. And it collapsed like a house of cards, I think very predictably. For years and years and years, I had this argument telling people, look, we need to do more. We need to do more if we ever want to leave responsibly. And people would say, we can't do nation building. Or they would say, it's too expensive, it's too hard, or whatever the excuse was. They said, we can't do more. And I would say, if we don't do more, we can't leave responsibly. And then last week happened.
Right. Well, and I guess that sort of takes care of the next question. Why didn't it work? What should we have done? What would have made this successful?
Well, let me zero in on 4 strategic errors that I think the United States made over the last 20 years. These are 4 decisions made by 4 presidents, and each of them could have and should have gone the other way. First decision is by President Bush to adopt a light footprint in Afghanistan. He went in with an intent to do kind of as little as possible. Donald Rumsfeld didn't like large operations. Bush was against nation building, tried to outsource it to the UN. And so we sent in only a few thousand troops to go find al-Qaeda and didn't do a whole lot else. Right? Light footprint, a lot of power vacuum in the provinces, Taliban returned. Second major strategic error, fast forward to 2009. President Obama had campaigned on a promise to win the war in Afghanistan. He did a surge in 09, spring 09, and another surge in late 09, which I think was correct. And he talked about counterinsurgency. And then he lost faith in his strategy, and he announced a series of withdrawal deadlines publicly in advance. He announced in December 09, he said, we're going to send more troops to Afghanistan and withdraw them in 18 months. Now, I've read military manuals. I've read strategists. I've never found a single one that says that's a smart way to fight war. In fact, they say pretty much closer to the opposite. You've got to fight a war. By definition, you go in until you achieve your goal, your end state. Wars, by definition, are open-ended. People don't like this idea that, like, we're going to get into an open-ended war in Afghanistan. And I want to turn that around and ask you, you want to fight a war on a timetable? Give me the example of when that's ever worked. World War II was an open-ended war. We declared war. We went to war until we won or we were defeated, right? So in Afghanistan, the idea that we're going to fight a war by timetable is strategically idiotic. It's just dumb. So that was the second major strategic error. The psychological impact was profound. It caused our allies in Afghanistan to hedge their bets. Our enemies in Afghanistan, they understood they could wait us out, which is exactly what they've done. Third major strategic error, fast forward again to 2020, when President Trump signs that baffling peace deal with the Taliban, which for my money is not a peace deal, it's a surrender deal. The deal that Trump signed a year and a half ago obligated the United States to withdraw by the mid-2021. And made no meaningful demands on the Taliban. It extracted no concessions from them that were enforceable. Taliban made a few vague promises, and we have no means of holding them to those promises. So it was a bad deal. And again, communicated to our allies, we're getting out of here, and told the Taliban, just sit around and wait, and you win. And so the fourth major strategic error was Biden's decision to actually honor that agreement, which to my mind is absolutely baffling. He repudiated most of the rest of President Trump's policies, rightly so. He talked about reviving American leadership. He talked about reviving the democratic world order, the free world. He's going to host a summit of democracies later on this year. He talked about putting human rights at the center of his foreign policy. And all of those things could lead him to say, we're going to stay committed to Afghanistan, like we've promised our Afghan allies. We've told them in writing. We're going to stand with them. And for the sake of human rights, for the sake of national security, for the sake of combating terrorists, we'll stay. Instead, very surprisingly, he said, nope, we're out of here. As soon as he did that, it caused a catastrophic collapse of morale in the Afghan army. And they concluded rationally that they can't win the fight. And so they're going to go home and not commit suicide by trying to fight the Taliban without our support.
I want to talk more about the withdrawal here in a minute, but let's assume an alternate reality where someone comes to you and says, you know, Dr. Miller, tell us what resources you need to successfully build a nation in Afghanistan and what practical steps we should be taking. What would you, here's your blank check. Yeah. Write something in, both practical and resource-wise. What do you write there?
So I think that we came pretty close to a I'm going to say successful strategy. You know, again, between 2007 and 11-ish, President Bush did recognize the problems. He started to pivot. He added more troops. He dumped a lot of money on the Afghan army in 2007 and 8. And then President Obama picked up the baton, and he continued that. And he added more troops. He talked about a civilian surge. So I would say take the Obama strategy, add the civilian surge, which he never really followed up on, and subtract the withdrawal deadlines, and we have a shot. It's still not kind of perfect and ideal, but it's achievable. I know that it's within the political will and the material resources of the U.S. government to have done that. So if you take Obama's strategy, pull out that withdrawal deadline, I can envision more meaningful negotiations with the Taliban, forcing them to real meaningful concessions. And maybe they turn into a political party and they, at least the moderates do, and they contest the election or something like that. Like that's not a wildly unrealistic scenario that could have happened around 2012, 2013.
I know what the words mean, but what do you mean by a civilian surge?
So remember how I said that we never actually did a whole lot of reconstruction and stabilization in those first 5 years or ever since 2011. What I mean is, both more money, but also more State Department officials, more USAID officials on the ground to oversee the reconstruction, to do grants and contract management, to prevent waste, fraud, and abuse. In other words, we had a ton of money, and we did drop a ton of money on Afghanistan. Quite a lot of it was wasteful because it wasn't done carefully, and it wasn't done up to international standards. And it's like after waiting for 6 years, we then panicked and we're like, okay, take all the money now. And it was kind of dumb, right? So what I would like to see is that kind of money spent more steadily, maybe at a lower volume but steadier pace over the two decades. And that does take some hands-on management by U.S. government civilians who are managing how the money's spent. That kind of civilian surge could have had more, could have been more effective at state building in the long run.
What would they be doing with the money? Like building roads, building schools, hiring teachers? I mean, what is the? What are they building with it? What are they accomplishing on the ground in Afghanistan other than just shipping, you know, more American bureaucrats over?
Yeah. I mean, so roads, schools, hospitals, power lines and irrigation channels, but most especially bureaucrats, right? We Americans, particularly if you're on the political right, we think, no, we need to limit the state and bureaucracy is bad. That's the luxury of having a state that actually functions, is that we get to worry about it being too big. In parts of the world like Afghanistan, where the state does not function, you actually need to make the state more effective and sort of bigger than it is. We complain about the DMV being inefficient and overbearing. But just like I drove around Kabul and not a single traffic light worked. So like I would like more technicians to actually fix the traffic lights so they work so that I can drive safely on the road. Like that's the kind of very basic kind of governance that Afghanistan never had, and we could have helped provide some of that or give them the skills and capabilities to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm, again, as a good conservative, I'm somewhat skeptical as to whether that can be brought in from without as opposed to being raised from within. But
so, yeah, it varies by policy sector. So something like a central bank, it actually turns out that's actually quite transferable because it's a highly technical set of skills that you transfer to a fairly small number of technocrats. And the Afghan Central Bank actually worked pretty well for most of the last 20 years. It is harder to do something like the justice sector, right? Because that means like you have to train 20,000 judges and 50,000 prosecutors to understand their legal code and apply it impartially. Okay, that's a vastly harder problem at scale. In between that are a whole lot of other things like just, yeah, again, building roads and training Afghans how to maintenance roads. That's not impossible. It's a pretty large problem, but it's not impossible. We didn't do a whole lot of that. Same kind of problem with operating power plants and dams and hydroelectric plants. Like it is conceivable to transfer the skills and material, but it does take some patience to do it in a sustainable way.
Well, we've left now, or at least I assume we've left. Is there any American presence left in Afghanistan at this point?
The United States military occupies the Kabul airport, and in a bit of an irony, President Biden was compelled to order several thousand more American troops to make sure that airport was secure and safe. He tried to withdraw and was sort of whiplashed back in because we now have 10 to 15,000 American citizens who are trapped in Afghanistan, potentially could become hostages of the Taliban, and we need to evacuate them. The fact that there's that many American civilians in the country when the government fell shows you how poorly planned this was and how abrupt the withdrawal was. It's a shocking, astonishing dereliction of duty by the Biden administration to allow this to have happened. Again, shows you just how catastrophic this withdrawal was. In addition to the Americans, there's also something like 100,000 Afghan refugees, specifically Afghans who worked with us over the past 20 years, worked with us as translators, soldiers, spies, human rights activists, or government officials, and they're going to be murdered if we don't get them out. This is what happened in South Vietnam when North Vietnam conquered the country and won. They just executed tens of thousands of people, and we owe it as a moral duty to get as many of them out as possible. It's not clear to me what we are able to do, but we're trying, and that's what's happening right now on the ground today, is evacuation. We're just flying plane loads of people out of the country. I think I saw yesterday, today's Friday the 20th, yesterday I think it was we got 2,000 people out, mostly American citizens, but there's also a whole lot of Afghans that we ought to get out as well. And we're going to be doing that for as long as we physically can and safely can. My big fear is we can only do this as long as the Taliban allow us. Right now, they've not attacked the airport. If they do attack the airport, it could be really, really ugly. I don't know what we can do about it. The Taliban are allowing American citizens into the airport to get them out. They're not doing that for the Afghans. And so there's a lot of Afghans that we owe it to them to get them out. I'm not sure how we're going to do that.
So I guess, again, the should we have left question you probably answered. What can be done now? What is Afghanistan going to look like in the next month, in the next year, and in the next 10 years?
Before I tackle that, your question was kind of should we have left. Let me address, if I can, an argument we've heard from the Biden administration and his sort of defenders that this was inevitable. Right. That's what the president said, is right. That we left, and maybe we should have left 10 years ago, according to him, because the war had already been lost. This was inevitable. It was going to happen sooner or later. There's nothing we could do to avoid it. And therefore, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. No, I think that's absolutely wrong. I disagree with that. There was nothing inevitable about this. This was almost an engineered crisis. It was a deliberate outcome of a policy choice by the Biden administration. The war was not lost. Previous to this, for the past 7 years, it was roughly stable. I have a lot of criticisms about the past strategy, but at least I'll say it didn't result in the complete collapse of the government and hundreds of thousands of refugees and an international public humiliation for the United States. For the past 7 years, the United States was in a supporting role. We were not engaged in ground combat against the Taliban in large numbers. It was a low risk, small, low-cost military presence that held the line against the Taliban because we worked with the Afghan army that we had trained and created, and they stood and fought for 10 years, and 55,000 of them died in combat against the Taliban fighting our common enemies. When the president says, failure was inevitable, the Afghans didn't fight, proving their heart was never in it, that's an insult to the Afghans who fought for 10 years and to the 55,000 who died in combat. It's libelous. It's wrong. It's a lie. And I have very little patience with the president or with his defenders when they say that this loss, this catastrophe was inevitable. We were holding the line. Again, the strategy could have been improved. It wasn't perfect, but I don't have to believe it was perfect to say it was better than what happened last week. Last week was a catastrophe and a disaster and a defeat. Let's call it for what it is. We did not end the war in Afghanistan. We lost the war in Afghanistan because President Biden pulled us out before we were ready.
So, again, what's next for Afghanistan? And then kind of the final question will be what should we do, both as individuals and as a nation? But let's start with what's next. What will Afghanistan look like, next month, next year, and then 10 years from now?
Well, the Taliban, they've won the war, and they are now the authority on the ground. So what's next for the Afghans is a return to the tyranny, the terror, and the barbarism that they knew in the 1990s. Right now, the Taliban is not doing that in Kabul because they're under the international spotlight. They've got a slick propaganda operation. They're spinning the international media. They've said that they've moderated, and they're going to respect women's rights, quote, within the bounds of Sharia law. But we all know what that means, right? We all know that that means there are no women's rights coming. And of course, there's no religious freedom at all. And I've heard, and there's a few reports out there anecdotally, of what the Taliban are doing out in the provinces, away from the scrutiny of the international media. They are going door to door. They're finding the soldiers who fought in the Afghan army, especially the special forces and the pilots. They're finding the translators. They're finding the human rights activists. And there are summary executions. There's summary imprisonment. They're making lists. They're taking names. Apparently, they may have actually seized the biometric database of all the Afghans from our embassy. I don't know if that's true, but I did read that somewhere. And so the Taliban are imposing their old style of brutality and tyranny on Afghanistan again. They're doing it again a bit quieter in the provinces. But I would say give it about 6 months when international attention has moved on, and you'll see it reemerge even in Kabul. So that's what's next for Afghanistan, is Taliban tyranny and terror, especially for the women, the religious minorities, and the new and small Afghan Christian community. There are Afghan Christians because of missionary efforts over the past 20 years, and I've also seen reports that they have received letters from the Taliban saying, we know who you are, and we're coming for you. So that, again, that's what's next. I also think what's next is that Al-Qaeda comes back. Al-Qaeda has always continued to exist, but they spent the last 20 years hiding. They had to use their energy avoiding our drones, our airstrikes, and our special forces. Now they don't. Now Al-Qaeda and its copycats, the Islamic State and other jihadist groups, they don't have to worry about our attacks anymore. They can focus their attention on rebuilding themselves, on training, recruiting, fundraising, and planning future attacks. So what's next is we are all at greater risk of international terrorist attack. I don't know if that looks like another 9/11. I do know that our homeland security is better than it was. But we just need to recognize, even if our defense is better, the international environment is worse than it was 20 years ago.
What role is Afghanistan as a nation now going to play on the international scene? Are they going to gravitate towards Iran, towards China, towards Russia? Are we going to continue to have some kind of relationship with them? Where are they going to end up?
Afghanistan is essentially a pawn of Pakistan now. It will not gravitate to Iran. Iran and the Taliban almost went to war in 1998. There's this whole Sunni-Shia divide there. So there's no love lost between them. Pakistan has long seen the Taliban more or less as their proxy, not always fully controllable, but Pakistan gave the Taliban some measure of support, either tacit or active, over the past 20 years, and they're quite happy with the Taliban's victory in this war. I think China also comes out as a winner. There's reports about the Taliban talking to Chinese diplomats to arrange trade deals and whatnot. More broadly, what role does Afghanistan play? I think Afghanistan becomes essentially a pariah again, as it was in the 1990s. I don't expect it to be a responsible member of the international community. But more broadly, I had a piece in the Dispatch yesterday making this point about the fall of Kabul. The Taliban's victory, the fall of Kabul, is not the most important geopolitical event of this century, but it doesn't need to be the most important for us to recognize that it is one more step along the path we've been walking for 30 years, the path of the erosion of the free world, the rise of authoritarianism, and the collapse of world order into a nasty, zero-sum, violent contest for power and prestige among the great powers. It's a collapse of world order. It's a collapse that happens gradually and then suddenly, right? You know your history. The assassination of an obscure archduke catalyzes the collapse of three empires and the redrawing of the world's maps. We don't know which straw will break the camel's back, and no straw takes responsibility for breaking the camel's back. But on hindsight, we know that every straw played its part. So the fall of Kabul is one more straw. And I don't know how close we are to breaking the back of world order, but I don't like getting close. I don't like playing with fire like this. And I am concerned that when we lose, when the free world loses, when we are demoralized, when we are exhausted, it gives room for the other side. Authoritarians around the world, it gives them room to steal a step, to take a tempo, that's a chess analogy, to steal a tempo on us. They're driving the agenda of world politics, and we are not. And that does worry me.
So what can be done, either by individual Americans or by the nation as a whole? What should we do now?
So the nation, the military, the State Department, their singular focus must be evacuating the refugees, the American citizens, and the Afghan refugees. We individuals can call up the local refugee resettlement agency. In my area, it's Lutheran Social Services. In a lot of the country, it's a Catholic charity. Look up your local refugee resettlement agency, and you'll find out ways that you can help Afghans who may be resettled in your area or elsewhere in the country, either by donating money or by donating time or materials or by forming relationships. When these people come to our country, they'll have lost everything. And yes, they need money for groceries, but they'll need relationships. They need a network. They need to learn how to be Americans, right? And we should welcome that, and we should maybe even be glad of the opportunity to enrich our country with their presence. Beyond that, that's the immediate crisis. Beyond that, we should be ready. Gosh, I hate to say this, but in Iraq, we left in 2011 and we were right back in 2014. Because in the intervening 3 years, Iraq collapsed, the Islamic State arose, and was close to conquering two countries. And the world knew that was unacceptable. I am afraid that something like that may happen in Afghanistan. I hope it doesn't. I'm not cheering for a re-intervention, but it may become necessary. And that may be what we need to be ready for. Probably not under the Biden administration. I don't think he'd do it. But it might be the next one. The next administration might be compelled to have some kind of re-intervention. Probably not on the scale that we just ended over the last 20 years. But it might be a short, might be an air war like the one against ISIS. But it may be necessary to keep ourselves safe from al-Qaeda, to be prepared to intervene again to fight those jihadist groups.
All right. Well, with that cheerful note, we'll leave things there unless you think there's anything else our listeners need to know about Afghanistan.
You know, maybe if you'll indulge me just a second here. I've been blathering about this all week nonstop to any journalist and podcaster who will listen. And the one thing maybe I haven't quite said is, you know, it's great that the world has paid attention this week. It's a little bit late, right? There was a lot of us kind of trying to raise the alarm bells much earlier, and we failed. And what happened. So that's why I kind of give the warning I do about the possibility of having to re-intervene. We as citizens in a democracy have a responsibility to pay attention. And I feel like we've become selfish and solipsistic and narcissistic and self-absorbed with our own problems and our own culture war. The world's a bigger place. We've got some responsibilities, both as a country, but as citizens as well. And so I would exhort and encourage everyone to pay attention, not to the immediate crisis, but to the world as a whole, because this is our home. This is where we live. And if we don't take care of it, bad things happen like what happened last weekend, and I don't want to see that happen again. It's one of the worst days of my life to watch that happen. It was just heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. And so please don't make us go through this again. Hold your elected officials accountable for their mistakes. Throw the bums out. And if you're listening to this and you are also sick and tired of the way people have run our country, run for office, right? We need sane, intelligent people to exercise some measure of authority, even just the local neighborhood, the city council, right? Get involved, stay informed, and hold your government accountable. That's what I want to say.
And what should our listeners be reading to do all of that?
I would say turn off the TV. I've never found a TV news program that's worth anything. I know that most Americans get their news from the TV, and I think that's one of the reasons the world is as bad as it is.
You're showing your age, Paul. Most Americans get their news from Facebook.
Yeah, you're right. But Facebook is just video clips from the TV.
Sure.
So I read, and I know all media has a bias. We're all adults. You learn to kind of edit it out and read biased stuff. But in print, it's more cerebral and less emotional, and so it should be easier for you to critically engage with it. I subscribe to the Washington Post. Sure, they lean left, but I'm an adult. I can handle it. I read the Atlantic, and I also read whatever pops up in my Twitter feed as well. And a lot of times that comes from sometimes the Wall Street Journal or National Review or something like that. I want better media. I read the Dispatch. I write for the Dispatch. I think it's a fantastic outlet. It's still new, young, and small, but I want to see things like that grow. So I encourage people to read and turn off the TV and Facebook.
Well, Dr. Miller, thanks so much for taking time to join us here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. And if things continue to develop, we'll certainly have you back on again.
I appreciate that, Quill. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.